Sure, let's have lunch with him. Yeah, he's free. Yeah, yeah, right. Great. Okay, that's great. That's great. That was a good meeting with those fellows last night.
Oh, it was really exciting. I called Chuck and I said, "It's so exciting. Poor Chuck is working away on this report."
Wow.
And I just, it's fun. I'm just really stimulated by the whole affair.
Yeah, I wish Judith had her tape recorder on last night.
Yes.
But that's...
I mean, for me, it's such an
maybe we should begin again today. Let me welcome you all again today, I think you. You know that the roundtables that the Commission has held over the past year have been possible only with the great support, moral and financial, of the Alaska Humanities Forum. And I think it's appropriate that I should express, on behalf of the Commission and of all of us, our deep appreciation to the Alaska Humanities Forum for the support that they have given us, and of course the work that they, through their state committee and Gary Holthaus, their executive director, have done in cooperation with us in planning and holding these forums. I think I should say that Hugh Brody is leaving this morning for London, England. He told us yesterday he had some bad news. His father died yesterday, and so he had to leave. And I know we all regret that sad event. And on another much less important level, we regret that he will not be with us for the next 3 days. I've taken the liberty of asking Josephine Bigler, who is with the United Methodist Church at Church House in New York, to participate in the roundtable today, particularly in light of the fact that Bishop DeRue will later on be addressing the paper that he prepared for us. Could I also at this time welcome Raina Green, who has arrived from Washington, D.C., and Dennis Demert, whom all Alaskans know from the University of Alaska in Fairbanks, and Clem Chartier, who is from Ottawa, Canada, and is the president of the World Council of Indigenous People. And I think it's appropriate that on this, the last public session of the Alaska Native Review Commission, Oscar Coagley, who should be here, one of the members of the executive committee of the Inuit Circumpolar Conference, and Clem Chartier, president of the World Council of Indigenous People, the two organizations that must bear the responsibility for establishing this commission. I don't know whether they want to brag about it or apologize for it, but it's their problem. Well, could I begin, because we have some members of the round table who have only just arrived, could I begin by seeking in just a very few minutes to recapitulate what was said yesterday? I know that those who were present will feel that that is impossible, and indeed it is, but let me do the best I can. We started out by considering the subject of the round table, that is, the place of native people in the Western world. And I had told you that after visiting 60 villages and towns in Alaska and taking testimony from more than 1,450 Alaska natives and other Alaskans, I thought it was an opportunity now to draw back and take a look at the picture from not an Alaskan perspective or even an American perspective, but from a new world or even a global perspective. And how far we succeeded in that yesterday is open to question, but at least we started off with that in mind. And Professor Lewis Hanke began by talking about the Spanish conquest, the principles enunciated by Bartolomé de Las Casas. Professor Hanke reminded us that Las Casas was the first to insist that the peoples of the New World, the native peoples, were entitled to the rights of entitled to human rights. He coined the expression, "All the peoples of the world are men." That, of course, was a phrase that might have been suitably modified in the 1980s to say all the peoples of the world are men and women, but no doubt we all understand that he meant that the peoples of the New World could not be enslaved and subjugated and their land taken from them. And Professor Hanke reminded us of the lifelong struggle by Las Casas to vindicate the rights of the indigenous peoples of the New World. We were reminded also of the notion that fairness towards the native peoples has been a constant theme of legislation and rhetorical pronunciamentos. We were reminded of the Northwest Ordinance, 1785 or thereabouts, in which the Congress, under the old Articles of Confederation, made it clear that in settling the Northwest Territories, the Native people's rights to land were to be respected. Those kinds of expressions of good intent can be found throughout the Americas. But as we were reminded, those principles that Native people are entitled to their land, that it cannot be taken from them except by their consent, that those principles have been honored more in the breach than in the observance. That in fact, when the European colonizers and their successors in the new regimes established in the New World, when they wanted land, they took it. And we were reminded of the history of the plains, and we were also reminded of the similar history of places as remote as Amazonia. Indeed, Sandy Davis reviewed for us the threats that face native peoples throughout Central and South America, and Bernard Nietzschman brought us up to date with the events recently occurring in Nicaragua and other places in Central America. Robert Goldwyn was good enough to insist that we all take a bit of a cold shower and that we ought to bear in mind, this was his contention, and there's a great deal of force in it, that the idea of growth or of increase, which animates European societies and those that have sprung from Europe, like the United States and Canada, but the idea of growth or increase, expanding, producing a surplus, improving what nature has provided, that these growth societies impinging on subsistence societies necessarily result in the aggrandizement of these growth societies and the deterioration of the situation and the conditions of the peoples in the subsistence societies. He pointed out that this idea of industrial and technological growth animates not only the Western democracies, but the Soviet Union, China, many countries of the Third World. He pointed out that it's a worldwide phenomenon and that it accounts for the universal diminution of the lands available to subsistence societies, especially indigenous societies throughout the world. Rosita Worrell and Doug Sanders and others then intervened to point out that Alaska Native people and Native peoples throughout North and South America are not necessarily to be categorized as purely subsistence societies, but indeed the fur trade was an instance of production of goods for external sale, that wasn't a purely subsistence society. We were reminded as well that in Alaska, Native people have been engaged in the commercial fishery for at least 100 years. That, I have found in the villages, is thought of in a broad sense as subsistence, and yet it is a commercial activity. It's impossible to establish hard and fast categorizations that apply throughout. Nevertheless, I think we all conceded the force of Robert Goldwyn's proposition. Well, notwithstanding all of that, Sheldon Kachetag reminded us that we are nevertheless confronted in Alaska with a situation in which, he said, the future of Alaska Natives as distinct peoples is in the balance. Bishop DeRue told us of the worldwide movement by indigenous peoples for self-determination and for a land base, and I took the liberty of quoting the words of Pope John Paul II in his statement given last year to Native peoples, in which he affirmed their right to self-determination and to a land base, he used the expression, addressing Native peoples, he said, "You are entitled to take your rightful place among the peoples of the earth." So we were brought to the present and reminded of the worldwide movement by indigenous peoples for self-determination and for land. Hugh Brody, before he left, sought to summarize the situation as he observed it here in Alaska. He pointed out that the land in Alaska, like the land in the circumpolar regions of the world, in Canada, Greenland, and no doubt even the Soviet Union, climate and geography render it unsuitable for agriculture, by and large, that it is not land that needs to be cleared to serve the purposes of the dominant societies of European origin, that there is therefore an opportunity in Alaska to do justice to the Native peoples, to affirm their right to self-determination and to participate in development where that is appropriate, industrial and technological change, and yet at the same time, for they have made it clear to me that they regard this as essential to their well-being, to continue to engage in subsistence hunting and fishing and trapping activities. And Hugh pointed out that that is a real possibility in the circumpolar regions, that the dynamic of growth societies, of which the U.S. and Canada are examples, Soviet Union is another, China is now another, the dynamic of those growth societies does not necessarily entail the taking of the land that Alaska Native people depend upon today. I think that's where the where we left, and as far as summaries will go, that I'm afraid we'll have to do. What I thought we would do this morning, and is this: David Case had one or two questions he wanted to ask Sandy Davis about Latin America before we move on. Then I thought we would ask Moses Keala from Hawaii to talk about the situation in Hawaii. We might pursue the ramifications of that with Moses and the other Hawaiians who have been good enough to come. And then we will turn to Bishop DeRue and ask him to discuss his paper. And I think that's been distributed, and you've all had a chance to read it. So, having exercised in that perhaps tenuous way my authority as chairman or moderator or whatever I am, maybe we could let David just finish up this discussion of Latin America.
I don't know if Bernard Nietzschmann is going to be here. I also wanted to ask him, but in any event, Sandy, let me just, in all of this, there's, especially in South America, there doesn't seem to be much real fires of hope, in the sense that Native people are really achieving settlements and situations that meet their aspirations. But there seem to me, in a couple of things that you mentioned and Bernard mentioned, some little sparks there. One was the Kuna Indians in Panama, and the other seemed to me to be the Miskito in Nicaragua. Although that's, I think, in flux right now. And the question, I guess, I have is, I'm not convinced. I mean, I think good ideas and right ideas are important in all of this, but probably not enough, not sufficient to achieve the aspirations that Native people have. And I wondered what happened in Panama that made it possible for the Kuna to reach an accord with the Panamanian government. What was the international or national situation in Panama at the time the Kuna were able to achieve their accord? And second, what is there about the situation with the Miskitos and the Sandinistas that gives the Miskito any bargaining power, any, what is their situation that makes it likely? What are they negotiating for in the first place, and what sort of levers do they have to negotiate with? And what if you could respond to those two, with those respect to those two peoples?
Comes here to discuss the Nicaragua situation. I think I'm going to pass the microphone in a moment to Doug Saunders. Maybe Clem wants to respond to this, because I take it the World Council of Indigenous People has recently met in Panama, and they have some first-hand experience with Panama that I don't have. The only thing I'd point out is, in the 1920s, I believe it was 1924, there was a treaty made that established the Comarca, which is a large land reserve, and within the treaty not only provided for the land base of the Kuna, but also provided, at least for some degree of limited sovereignty, of home rule by the traditional leadership of the Kuna. So the Kuna are one of the few people that have had a territorial base through a treaty with the state that has been respected and have been able to maintain political, some degree of political autonomy. The third aspect, which is more modern, is that has taken place in the last 10 years, for example, is the development of an autonomous economy. In some sense, that is trying to maintain itself in terms of a traditional slash burn agricultural economy, also the use of marine resources by gaining some control over colonization that's taking place, especially on the mainland. The Kuna have recently established an accord with the Panamanian government to create a forest reserve on the coast that will be used by the Kuna for their own traditional economic needs, and as well as be used as a place for scientific tourism, for expeditions that will come to study this area, and for other forms of tourism that will be totally controlled by the Kuna themselves. So they've been able to maintain a land base, have some degree of political autonomy, and begin to maintain their own economic structure in the area. Doug may want to say more. Let me just say one reason why I think this was possible is because at the time when the treaty was made, the Kuna were able to play off other international actors that were interested in that area. One was the United States Navy that had a warship off the coast at the time, in playing off the U.S. Navy against the Panamanian government, I believe. The other was the Colombian government that was making a claim on the San Blas Islands and on the Darien Gap, which is a historic claim. And the Kuna, by playing off the U.S. and Colombia against Panama, were able to use some political leverage to create this treaty. There's probably much more to that. So I think that there may be a lesson there about how you go about negotiating with a state and how you could do it. But let me pass it on to Doug, though.
It's fairly central in understanding Central America to understand that while the countries by North American standards are very small, that they are not unified in geographical and demographic terms. There is a spine of mountains which extends through Central America, which has the result that the Atlantic coast side has very small, very light population densities compared to the Pacific coast side. This was true in pre-contact times, and it's true down to the present time, so that all the way down the coast, the Atlantic coast of Central America, you find the population is completely different on the Atlantic side than on the Pacific side. The tremendous mestizo Spanish Indian populations are on the Pacific side. On the Atlantic side, you have impact from British colonialism in the Caribbean. You have land which was not perceived as having potential for agricultural development, such as happened on the Pacific side. At the time of the revolution in Nicaragua, as an example, there was no all-weather road from the Pacific side to the Atlantic side, and while the province on the Atlantic side, the province of Zelaya, comprises about half of the country, the population is extremely small, and there are vast areas really with no extensive settlement at all. And this is a direct result from the nature of the land, which is simply not of the productive capacity of the land on the Pacific side. In the specific example of Panama, you still don't have, there may now be a road that you can get through to the Cuna area, but transportation into there is by boat or by plane. The Cuna had early contact with English-speaking traders and also some non-English European countries. You have a long history of the Cuna becoming fascinated with this contact internationally. You had Cuna who went on trading ships around the world, came back. You had very interesting processes of modernization within the Cuna society, and a restructuring of the traditional government to a point where it was reformulated into essentially three regional groups within a Cuna-wide government. They occupy a series of small islands on the Atlantic coast of Panama. Panama is essentially an east-west country, as you may realize, and this is on the Columbia end or the east end of the Atlantic side. Now, this area had the tremendous protection of isolation, and so in the 1920s, when the Tule Revolt occurred, there was a very small number of Panamanian officials or military in the Cuna area. It was in fact physically very easy for the Tule Revolt to occur, and as Sandy has indicated, the English-speaking connections which the Cuna had for quite a while were in this period with aided by U.S. military boat offshore, which gave added difficulty for the Panamanians in terms of invading the area, but it would have been extremely difficult anyway. For 5 years, the major part of the Cuna area was treated as being independent, as the Tule Republic. At the end of that period, the Cuna negotiated their way back in to Panama. They had a document which Bernard referred to yesterday, the Carta Organica, the constitution describing the Cuna form of government. When they negotiated back in, they came in as a territory. The term comarca is now perceived in Panama as unique. In fact, it had a very strange analogy at the time. Two comarcas had previously been set up as concessions to the United Fruit Company for banana plantations. So it's a very interesting example of the conceptual transformation of a concept. So from an analogy to a banana plantation, an analogy now forgotten in Panama, it is now seen as a model for autonomy. Well, perhaps that's not so funny. United Fruit had tremendous autonomy, of course, in terms of in its relations with the government structures in Central America. So what it has emerged out into then is a territory, not a province. There are provinces within Panama, but it is somehow a parallel, and if you ask exactly why it is different, it is hard to get an answer, except that none of the other provinces have their own constitution and a traditional form of government in the way that has been codified by the Kuna themselves under a Carta Organica. And in codifying it, we brought in an outside lawyer and got it written up in Spanish, formalized, so there was some meeting of literacy in the sense of the Panamanian legal system. A document was produced which the Panamanian legal system could respond to easily, saying, all right, we understand what these rules are. Panamanian law then did two things. In terms of the internal government structure of San Blas, the comarca, it simply referred to the Carta Organica. It did not reproduce it. So you do not find the Carta Organica repeated in Panamanian law and given force. It is simply referred to as the form of government there. Now, crucial in the maintenance of the autonomy of San Blas has been the fact that they have an independent economy. They have coconut plantations, they have a lot of harvesting from the sea, plus the English-speaking tradition, which goes back to the early contact with traders, turned out to be an economic advantage. And a large number of Kuna worked for the Americans in the canal zone. So, which created a very, some tense moments of political relationship between Panama and the Kuna as the issues of the canal were fought over a number of years. But this indicated in many ways that the Kuna were a real political grouping within the country. National political decisions had to take into account the fact that this group had substantial autonomy and were different in very, very fundamental ways from any other grouping in the country. Not simply in traditional ways, although they're very traditional people, but also in other modern ways, which had impact on the nation state. There were particular development projects which emerged. The government of Panama did some studying in terms of tourism and said it was very common for people to fly over to San Blas, tourists to fly over to San Blas, and it's a beautiful area, particularly for anyone from Canada. It's the most ideal Indian reserve in the world, with tropical islands. It was just marvelous. And so the idea was that if we can only get the tourists to stay the second day, a basic stratagem of anybody planning tourism, so okay, can we plunk a holiday in on the San Blas Islands? Well, the San Blas Kuna had traditionally been quite exclusive, and there is extremely little intermarriage, and there was great reluctance for any plan to have substantial numbers of tourists come and stay on the islands. And so you had a fight, an autonomy fight, between San Blas's version of how tourism should be organized and Panama's version, and Panama lost. The Kuna approach to tourism was the one that prevailed. You now have two small hotels in the area, both of which are locally owned and very much reflect local mores. I was telling people at dinner last night, I arrived at one and was greeted with great enthusiasm on the basis that I was a Canadian, which puzzled me completely because I didn't think that we were sort of universally regarded as wonderful. Or that we were universally recognized as anything in particular. Panama has about 300 or 400 different kinds of banks because it's a banking center for all of Central and South America. But the Vicuña owner of this hotel had gotten two loans from the Bank of Nova Scotia, a well-established Canadian institution, and so he had great love for Canadians. What's interesting about the Vicuña example is that it emerges on its own for its own political history and reflects the degree of organization of the population and its isolation and its separate economic base. It does not become a model until extremely recently. And so Panama, in its national, did not have a national indigenous policy. It in fact had the most successful system of autonomy for a tribal group of any of the groupings, I think, in the Americas. And yet for the Guarani that Bishop DeRue referred to yesterday, the situation was totally different, and gradual encroachments on the land base of the Guarani continued. There was supposed to be a formalization of the boundaries of the Guarani lands in western Panama. That did not happen. The plan of dropping an enormous copper mine in the middle of Guarani territory proceeded as part of a national development strategy without Guarani interests being adequately taken into account, the decision in the end not to go ahead with Cerro Colorado had far more to do with world copper prices than anything else. What's interesting in this situation, the two aspects of the Guarani situation which are fascinating, one is that the Guarani, more than any other grouping in Central and South America, launched an international strategy to bring their situation to the attention of the Panamanian government and the world. For a number of years, if there is any international conferences dealing with indigenous rights, meetings in Geneva, the UN, or anything else, Guarani will be there. Sandy Davis organized a conference in Washington a couple of years ago on multinationals and indigenous peoples, representatives speaking for the Guarani people, attended that. The impact of this international strategy, which has been pursued consistently by a relatively limited number of indigenous groups, has proven as somewhat successful in the Panamanian situation. One of the results has been the Panamanian government accepting the Comarca model, that is the model of Vicuña and San Blas, as a model to be followed in relation to the Guarani. And now Bernard Nietzschmann mentioned yesterday, and I had not known this, in the Mosquito negotiations in Bogota with the Sandinistas, he stated that the prime model which had been held out by the Mosquito to the Sandinista government was the autonomy of the Vicuña of San Blas. I found in an organization of lawyers that I've been involved in for a number of years, the Association of American Jurists, that the lawyers for Central and South America were not only astonishingly ignorant about the Indian situation in other countries in Central and South America, but they didn't even know the Indian situation in their own countries. And so Bernard was suggesting that the model of the Comarca of San Blas, in fact, was not known to the Sandinistas. Their viewpoint represented the dominant mestizo cultural and political orientation of Central America. A fascinating and highly successful situation like the Kuna autonomy in Panama, was unknown to them. A complete blind spot, which for outsiders interested in this is very perplexing. One has to, in fact, understand quite complex and extremely well-established mental blocks to understand why that model was not at least passingly known in the area. Now it's becoming very useful and a very positive model to be applied to other areas. So it becomes a kind of resource. The achievement of the Kuna become a great resource for other indigenous groups in Central America.
Talking about any idea of relative populations?
I'm sorry, I can get it for you. I think we're talking something around 7,000. I'd have to check it carefully to be precisely sure. Panama is relatively small in total. It's about 2.8 million people. The Guarani population is larger than the Kuna population. Those are the two largest groupings within the country. In the Kuna area, there is almost no non-Kuna residents. There are a few teachers and inevitable missionaries, but otherwise it is quite impressive the degree to which this is overwhelmingly Indian run and Indian populated.
That's fascinating. Thank you. David Case, are the Mosquito also located on the Atlantic coast of Nicaragua?
You have the same phenomenon of isolation in relation to both groups. You also have the same phenomenon of English connection. The Mosquito absorbed into their population a number of English-speaking Caribbean blacks who came over from English colonization on the Caribbean islands. The identification never wavered. This was an Indian identification. This was a group that was absorbed in. The predominant languages are Mosquito and English, and the prominent religion is Moravian from missionary activity in the latter part of the 19th century. The points of difference between the Mosquito and the Spaniards, as they call the mestizo majority on the Pacific side, are, I think, more extensive than certainly between the Kuna and the dominant population of Panama, although they are somewhat analogous. And certainly the physical isolation of the two areas is very compatible. One of the great differences would be the nature of the social organization of the Mosquitoes compared to the Kuna. The Mosquitoes lived, before the relocations at least, in something, I think, over 200 small villages on the river systems in the old area of Mosquito, which is the sort of northeastern corner of Nicaragua, you did not have centralized institutions. It was a small village phenomenon. And in this, you have a very interesting parallel between the Miskito and the Guayame, which were which the anthropologists identified as particularly interesting as an example of small-scale organization, although you have a large contiguous area of almost exclusive Guayame population. You do not have large-scale political organization. It is small-scale village and extended kinship, a structure which is weak in terms of dealing with a highly organized outside force. And so the Guayame and the Miskito have traditionally shared that kind of social organization, in distinct contrast to the Kuna, who had regional organization and in the context of specifically of dealing with the Panamanian majority, went a step beyond that and reorganized into a kind of federal structure in which you have a government for the whole of the San Blas Kuna area.
Bishop Drew just pointed out that the Guayame number 7,000. Concharche, did you want to add anything to that subject before we move on?
Well, just briefly, for the record, Doug Sanders has been with the World Council for over a decade, and he's very well versed in the statistical matters and knowledge of the membership within the World Council, so I have no difficulty with his pronouncements. I'll make the political ones, but I just wanted to state that it is a difficult situation, and I guess, again, I've only been elected at the end of September of last year, and I don't pretend to be an expert or even to know much about the situation in South and Central America. It's very complex, or I've been trying to analyze it over the past 6 years through written material mainly, and talking to Doug and other people, and I have a long way to go. I just want to, and the other thing, it's hard to generalize. Even a small area like Central America has a lot of diverse situations, and it's just impossible to make comparisons. Well, you can make comparisons, but you can't generalize about the situation, again, because of the geography, and I think because of the history of the development of that area through colonization and the different political forces that have taken place and are still continuing, particularly now with over the past 150 some years or longer of the involvement of the United States in that area and the United States policy. But one of the things that I've noticed, one of the things that we've discussed at our meetings, is the notion of indigenous ideology and the fact that, generally speaking, the indigenous peoples, the Indian peoples in the Americas, South and Central America, are caught between the right and the left. That is, you know, not so much the case in North America. It's more pronounced in Central America. And the Indian peoples, of course, are stating, you know, we are an Indian people. We have our own ideology, and we want to develop ourselves and our nations according to what we believe is rightfully ours. And I guess it's expressed in the term self-determination. And that is correctly one of the things that is foremost at the meetings that I've attended and is foremost with respect to the political platform of the World Council of Indigenous Peoples. Of course, coupled with the fight between the left and the right is the fact of the environment, the culture, and the institutions of the Indigenous peoples, and these vary from region to region. Even, say, within a country like Panama, as was mentioned, that sort of sets the starting point of the conflict between the Indigenous peoples in those countries and the colonizing forces, with specific reference to the mosquito situation. Again, I'm not an expert, but I am on the World Council of Indigenous Peoples Nicaraguan Commission. We set up a commission to deal with the reunification of the mosquito family. Myself and the two vice presidents of the World Council make up that commission. As such, we did travel to Central America. We were briefly in Honduras for a meeting that never did come about because of political forces. And we did travel to Nicaragua, met with the chief negotiator for the Sandinista government, Luis Carrion, as well as representatives of the Moravian Church and an organization known as CPAD. I think it's the Evangelical Organization. So we were able to try to get some information. We didn't have time, unfortunately, to travel to the Atlantic coast. But when speaking to the government, they stated that basically they realized that mistakes were made in the past and they are prepared to take corrective measures. Now, one of the things they said they were currently willing to engage in is the recognition that Indian peoples have special rights over and above that of the ordinary Nicaraguan citizen, particularly with respect to land rights and to some form of autonomy. The only thing remaining, I guess, was to determine what that meant, what self-government meant, and with the reservation or the expressed fear that they realize that the Indians do have to have a land base, as they are stating, but they have great fears that this may eventually lead to separation. But realizing that fear, they state that nevertheless they're prepared to embark in that direction. It sounded very good. At the meeting in Bogota, things did not move very quickly. The government, basically in the negotiations, which we were there as observers, but not in the same room. So I think basically we weren't observers as such, but more, I suppose, guarantors. If and when an agreement was reached, it would have been explained to us in our presence, so that way we could have observed, I guess, the conclusion and have been witnesses to any agreement. So if there was a future breach, other people besides the mosquito delegation and the government would have had knowledge of it or been privy to the agreement. The government, according to the information we received from Brooklyn Rivera and the other, I think, three mosquito negotiators, had difficulty in even accepting the notion or the term Indigenous peoples or Indian peoples. It was reflected in one of the documents in response to a
very well-written-out accord.